Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents An Honorable Exit by Eric Vuillard. Translated by Mark Polizotti. Narrated by Malcolm Hilgartner. Top Secret Addendum to a Report on the Labor Inspection. One must travel, wrote Montaigne. Travel makes one modest, Flaubert added. And Ten took it up a notch. We travel for a change, not of place, but of ideas. But what if the opposite were true? In a travel guide to Indochina from 1923, after a page advertising the firm of Ridet and Company, a gunsmith located in the center of Hanoi, providing weapons and munitions for hunting and warfare, all accessories for hunters and tourists, automatic pistols or rifles, this before any mention of picturesque Upper Tonkin, abounding in natural curiosities. We come across a brief dictionary, a conversation manual for vacationers, in which the first rudiments are, go find me a rickshaw, go quickly, go quietly, turn right, turn left, turn back, put up the top, put down the top, wait for me a moment, take me to the bank, to the jeweler's, to the cafe, to the police station, to the dealership. This was the basic vocabulary for a French tourist in Indochina. On June 25, 1928, at the crack of dawn, three austere figures set out from Saigon on a short journey. A wisp of fog hung over the buildings. The car drove quickly. Even with the top up, it was chilly out, and before long the front seat passenger wrapped himself in a blanket. As it happened, Tolons, Delamar, and their secretary were hardly your average travelers. They formed the kernel of a new colonial administration and were the very first labor inspectors appointed to French Indochina. Suspicions of ill-treatment at a Michelin plantation had made a lot of noise, and after a revolt by the workers, they had been assigned to ensure that the paltry regulations serving as a labor code were being followed, ostensibly for the Vietnamese coolies' protection. Soon the car left the city outskirts for rows of thatched huts. The landscape was beautiful, of an almost aggressive green. The river overspilled its banks, and behind a narrow strip of land you could glimpse a multitude of small, sparkling patches of water. Finally the path plunged into the forest, and the travelers felt both a kind of enchantment and a vague anxiety. On each side of the road was an immobile parade, implacably repeated. They entered an immense forest. But this was no typical forest, neither a wild, overgrown tropical rainforest, nor the dark, dense forest of dreams where children get lost. No, this forest was stranger still, perhaps even wilder and darker. Entering it, the travelers shuddered. It seemed that in this forest, by a curious sorcery, all the trees grew at exactly the same distance from one another. One tree, then another tree, then another and another, as if the forest were composed of a single specimen multiplied ad infinitum. At night, in the cold hours, men pace steadily from tree to tree, gripping small knives. It takes them 5 seconds to go several short steps. Then they bend down, straighten up, and leave a gash in the tree's bark. These efforts take a maximum of 15 seconds. And so, more or less every 20 seconds, each man reaches another tree, and in the next row another man follows him, and over hundreds and hundreds of meters, hundreds of men advance, barefoot and in canvas trousers, lantern in one hand and knife in the other, and slice the bark. Then the tree slowly begins to drip. It looks like milk, but it's not milk. It's latex. And every night, each man bleeds roughly 1,800 trees. 1,800 times the man takes his knife to the bark. 1,800 times he makes a notch, cutting off a fine strip about 2 millimeters thick. 1,800 times he must be careful not to touch the heartwood. And as our inspectors cross through the endless plantation in their car, even as they admire how Taylor and Michelin have managed to ward off the natural idleness of the Annamite workers via rationally organized labor, even as they stare transfixed at the glacial immensity of the work, marveling at the extent to which this forest, the pitiless organization of this forest, represents an unprecedented struggle against wasted time, they experience a kind of terror. But even the best regulated system has its failures. And at 9 o'clock that morning, about 20 kilometers before their arrival at the plantation office, Labor Inspector Emile Delamar noticed 3 young Tonkinese by the side of the road. He was unfortunate enough to lean out and saw that they were bound together with iron wire. It must have seemed odd to him, incongruous, these 3 shoeless men tied together, and so he immediately ordered his driver to stop. The 3 men were filthy, dressed in rags. They were under a foreman's supervision. Delamar got out of the car a little groggily, stumbled in the mud, and advanced with difficulty toward the prisoners. Once he'd reached them, he looked for a moment at the foreman, who, at the sight of Delamar's expensive suit, doffed his hat. The air was already warm and humid. Delamar noticed that the prisoners were covered with scabies. At a glance, he saw that the metal wire was digging into their wrists, and he decided to question them directly in Vietnamese. After a banal exchange of words and some hesitation, one of them said he had tried to escape. He was what they called a deserter. He had run away from the plantation under cover of darkness, but had just been recaptured. Delamar no doubt found the punishment disproportionate, but it wasn't really his purview. He contented himself with a curt remark to the foreman, then turned around, scraped his soles on the roadside, and got back into the car. "To the plantation," he ordered. During the rest of the trip, he tried to forget that painful scene, and, thank God, when they arrived at the plantation, they were treated to a warm welcome. After a cursory glimpse of the facilities, they were introduced to the director of the Michelin establishments in Cochin China, Monsieur Alpha, accompanied by the plantation manager, Monsieur Trahier, and several European employees. The group of them made a more extensive tour. The coolie housing, tiny garden plots, showers, infirmary, quartermaster's stores, water tower. The inspectors viewed the new equipment with admiration. As they emerged from the structures, Delamar, seizing on a moment alone with the director, inquired about the stocks he'd noticed at the beginning of their visit near the housing. Monsieur Alpha looked uncomfortably surprised. He turned to his aide, Monsieur Trier, and asked for an explanation. "I built that for the deserters," Trier said a bit sheepishly. "We don't keep them longer than one night, and only attached by 1 foot. Are there other stocks on the plantation?" Delamar asked. "Not a one," Trier answered categorically. The visit continued. Now they were at the kitchens. They were to get a complete tour of the premises. Trier began by vaunting the modern layout, the cleanliness. Suddenly, as they passed a closed door, Delamar asked what was behind it. The other man answered with a shrug, probably a closet, he didn't have the keys. As Delamar insisted on entering, Trier went off to find them. Finally, the supervisor returned breathless and opened the door. The room was empty of people, but at the back were stocks with 9 footholes. The director turned sharply to Trier and demanded an explanation. Trier stammered. The director raised his voice. But just as in the theater, a little farce is played out in the foreground that is contradicted by something in the background, they suddenly heard moans coming from the adjacent room. Again, the door was locked. Again, they'd have to fetch the keys. On the strength of his authority, the labor inspector furiously ordered them to break the door down. And lo and behold, it suddenly opened. They had miraculously found the keys. What a scatterbrain that Trier is! But instead of defusing the situation, this strange blunder only heightened an obscure fear that had slowly been permeating the labor inspectors. And as the door opens, they can feel it fully now. and the moans grow louder, they enter another world. A man is lying on his back, spent, exhausted, both feet bound, half naked. The man is writhing on the floor, trying desperately to cover his genitals with a filthy rag that he clutches against him as best he can. Then, as the small group stands there, stunned by what they have just discovered, Friere rushes up and, ripping away the rag that the poor man was holding to his trembling, emaciated body, cries, "Let's hope he hasn't hurt himself." The remark is incongruous, and the labor inspector doesn't immediately understand what he meant. Is Trier suggesting that the man has been bound like this for his own good? The coolie was now almost naked, for all to see. It was a horrific scene. They freed him from his shackles, stood him up, and the guards roughly examined every inch of his body, as if the man had tried to kill himself or was concealing something. The room was poorly lit, sordid. The man was atrociously thin. He could barely stand. He was terrified. The director reprimanded Trier. "What the hell is going on here?" he cried. "I don't know, sir," Trier repeated over and over, shouting in turn at a guard to fetch an orderly. "Now!" They had to wait. The wait was endless. The Vietnamese man was skeletal, moribund, forced to remain standing amid the directors and the two strangers whose language he didn't speak. He swayed, and the Frenchman fell silent. Now and then a drop of rain fell heavily on the sheet metal roof. A gust of cool air blew through the room. And Trier repeated, as if to himself, "I don't understand." Finally, the orderly arrived. Perhaps he thought to reassure the inspectors by stating that he was treating a dysentery case, but this surprising declaration only made the atmosphere more tense. Delamar thought, "And this is how you cure him? By chaining him half-naked to a post?" He ordered in a cold voice, "Strip this man down completely." Trier made a sign to the two guards. The coolie recoiled in fear, but he was too weak to resist. They removed his undershirt. The man was now entirely naked, as we will be one day before our judges. He stood with his head bowed. He looked dead. Inspector Delamar approached the man slowly, very slowly, and walked around him. He motioned for his colleague to come closer. "I would like you to note that this man's back bears distinct traces of 6 cane blows." The next day, Delamar went to the other Michelin plantation, where several suicides by hanging had recently been reported. The Michelin firm was wondering about the reasons for this epidemic of suicides, as the labor inspector's report put it. From the list he'd been given, these suicides had occurred with alarming frequency. Pham Thi Nhi by hanging on May 19, Pham Van App by hanging on May 21st, Ta Dinh Tri by hanging the same day, Le Ba Han by hanging on the 24th, Do Te Thuat by hanging on June 10th, Nguyen Sang by hanging on June 13th, Tran Cook by hanging that very morning. In all, 7 suicides in 1 month. During his tour, the inspector discovers deep contusions on the coolies, and when he questions them, out comes a flood of stories of humiliation and terror, and, despite the denials, Delamar comes upon a whole bundle of canes in a closet. And as usual, the plantation director knows nothing about it. And as usual, he seems very afflicted, declares that if only he'd known about certain excesses, if only he'd put a stop to them sooner by transferring an overly zealous young assistant, he could never have imagined such outbursts. And, as usual, the director expresses his profound regret. And, as usual, these abuses are chalked up to exceptions, blunders, the cruelty of the guard, the sadism of a subaltern. The inspector draws up a scrupulous report, and the administration formulates a few recommendations. They result in not one single reform or indictment. That year, the Michelin firm realizes a record profit of 93 million francs. Several years earlier, André Michelin had made the acquaintance of Frederick Winslow Taylor on the occasion of a luncheon held in the latter's honor at the Prunier restaurant in Paris. Over dessert, Taylor, who according to Michelin's account was modesty itself, had shyly spelled out for them the basic tenets of his method. But to better understand André Michelin's admiration for Taylor's theories, to truly experience the dread the labor inspectors felt as their car rolled at daybreak past that geometric forest, where all the trees were planted at equal intervals, so that each coolie could always take the same number of steps at the same cadence, to fully grasp what is meant by Taylor's modesty, the quality Michelin saw in him. Let us quote this small excerpt from Frederick W. Taylor's Shop Management, in which he debuted his Principles of Scientific Management. A man with only the intelligence of an average laborer can be taught to do the most difficult and delicate work if it is repeated enough times, and his lower mental caliber renders him more fit than the mechanic to stand the monotony of repetition. Thus, according to Taylor, Femme Tigny, ID number 2762, who hanged himself on May 19, 1928 at the plantation of Dao Tieng, was nothing other than a man with only the intelligence of an average laborer taught to do the most repetitive work. It appears, however, that despite his lower mental caliber, he couldn't abide the monotony of repetition. And Pham Van Aap, ID number 1309, who hanged himself on May 21, 1928, was also nothing other than a man with only the intelligence of an average laborer taught to do the most repetitive work. And yet he, too, was apparently unable to withstand the monotony of repetition. That same year, 30% of the workmen died on the plantation, more than 300 people. Delamar again saw the thin wrists, gashed by iron wire, of the three haggard captives, those deserters with vacant eyes, whom he had encountered at dawn. He felt ashamed. The truth was there, plain as day. What difference did their miserable labor contract make when it could be used to coerce them like that? Getting back on the road that evening, Inspector Delamar understood that, by running away from the plantation, these men were only trying to save their skins. Dupont of the Lodges. The Tonkin region of the north of Vietnam abounds in extraordinary hilly landscapes, which travel writers refer to as dreamscapes. The steep cliffs, limpid lakes, and prodigious waterfalls seem to come straight out of a Chinese painting. It's as if they've been painted with a worn-down brush, so that the minimal lines suggest only a misty frontier. But by September 1950, the military outpost, from which the French had been admiring these sublime landscapes for a quarter century, was receiving provisions only by air, leaving it dangerously isolated. It was tricky getting hold of airdropped supplies, and they were beginning to worry about having enough food. The situation was growing dire. The plantations had been deserted by large contingents of workers who had joined the rebellion. The French were now facing a veritable army, and so, after much hesitation, the French general staff resigned itself to evacuating the position. Too late. The very day the evacuation order was sent, the Viet Minh launched a blistering attack. The French immediately parachuted in legionnaires as reinforcements, but the assault was so swift and lethal that they didn't even have time to intervene, and the post fell. From one bloody misadventure to the next, from order to ill-advised counter-order, the regiment that had evacuated from Cao Bang advanced painstakingly through the jungle. It finally managed to reach a second column, but by nightfall, their situation becoming ever more alarming, attacked from all sides, the survivors attempted a desperate retreat. The enemy gave them no quarter, and after many fierce clashes, the two columns were annihilated. Some 10 days later, on Thursday, October 19, 1950, at the National Assembly in Paris. Édouard Herriot, presiding, addressed a formulaic homage to our armed forces, our heroic soldiers. He then evoked their struggle in Indochina with great dignity. He even deemed it appropriate to add that their mission was to ensure the independence of a nation associated with our country in the context of the French Union. He cast a circular glance around the chamber. The benches were full. Once he had duly expressed our deep condolences to the grieving families, he quickly moved on and ceded the floor to the first interpolator, Monsieur Juge. In the name of the communist delegation, the deputy asked how the government intended to respond to Ho Chi Minh's offer of an exchange of prisoners. His speech lasted several minutes. The other deputies began to yawn. It was so unseasonably warm that October. Ties were loosened, belts undone by a notch. Finally, 15 minutes later, another deputy, Frédéric Dupont, took the floor, and immediately the benches woke up. It's just that Frédéric Dupont was not your usual parliamentarian, but a deputy, capital D, with loud opinions. To do him justice, we should add that a considerable share of his reputation came from his fervent interest in the concierges of apartment buildings. They say he introduced dozens and dozens of bills aimed at improving their meager living conditions, hence his nickname, Dupont of the Lodges. It is profoundly moving to note such fidelity to an unjustly despised guild, to those passive, hard-working witnesses to our lives who sort our mail, bar unwanted visitors, and take out our trash. But to better understand our deputy's commitment to them, we must go back to the criteria of their recruitment. For this, we have to linger a moment on the life of Jean Chiappe, the famous police commissioner, one of the founders of modern policing, an assiduous reader of the right-wing rags Le Gringoire and L'Action Française. Chiappe especially admired the reactionary polemical writer Charles Maurras. In the evening, his back pressed against a hot water bottle, constipated, he feverishly leafed through the master's pamphlets and political diatribes, hoping against hope that from them would spring the energetic regime that could redeem France. When he was in a good mood, say after a propitious haul or the successful repression of a strike, he sighed beneath his bedside lamp under the weft of imaginary loves that Maurras spun in his provincial reveries. But Jean Chiappe's true passion was his job. A zealot, he filled the ranks of peacekeepers with as many toughs, thugs, and agitators as possible in order to have a police force that was battle-hardened, accommodating, and narrow-minded. To improve the daily lot of his shock troops, he helped to get their wives' jobs as concierges to fatten the kitty. And besides, you can never have enough information about unkempt tenants or unstable petty landlords. It was therefore judicious to stuff the concierge lodges of Paris with reliable individuals. We now understand better why Frédéric Dupont, who fell in line with Chiappe's convictions, would tirelessly support the concierges. He was actually supporting a veritable army of poll workers, missionaries, touts, barroom propagandists. And more than anything, he was boosting a diligent, effective clientele, the spouses of his peacekeepers, an armada of informants. Frédéric Dupont was therefore not merely the extravagant legendary deputy, the excessive and whimsical maniac that his former colleagues describe. And so, while Frédéric Dupont studiously walks down the aisle that October 19, 1950, shaking a few hands and uttering a few pleasantries along the way, let's unspool his long career for a closer look. Let's pick up the book lying on his bedside table and quickly leaf through the minor novel of his existence. Édouard Frédéric Dupont was born in the 7th arrondissement of Paris and was a true native of the neighborhood, speaking its lingo, knowing its codes, wearing its livery. He had an odd kisser, did Dupont, though, to be fair, he received a head wound while marching in the fascist riots of February 1934, and maybe that accounted for his unpleasant moon face. But the residents of the 7th arrondissement recompensed him for that war wound, constantly electing and re-electing him with something like 95% of the vote, veritable plebiscites. A devotee of General Franco, he later voted to grant Marshal Pétain full powers. In 1941 he became vice president of the Council of Paris, but feeling the wind change, he then refused to support the proposed budget for 1944. Finally, he resigned from the council, mere moments before its collapse. Several months later, France was liberated. This act of bravery earned him in extremis the Medallion of the Resistance and the Legion of Honor. But let's move on now and leap over a few hedges. To recap his prodigious career, 62 years as an elected official in Paris, a record, 13 tenures as deputy, more than 40 years of parliamentary life. He served under three republics and was a member of 10 political parties, ultimately running as a Front National candidate alongside Olivier d'Ormesson. But more than anything, Dupont of the Chatterboxes, as they affectionately called him in the back rooms, was a great champion of reforms. Among his most notable achievements, he was involved in the creation of the Paris Beltway, the building of a parking lot, and the restoration of the Invalides Gardens. A stellar record. But on that October 19, 1950, Frédéric Dupont is at one of the summits of his career. The war in Indochina has put him front and center. He is a one-man preservation society for the empire and the advocate of our army. A flatus of luminescence wafts from the skylight. The scribes discreetly take turns near the podium. Dupont hitches up his breeches. Plus sizes sure aren't what they used to be. Does up the second button of his jacket, of a cut that flatters his embonpoint, making sure it isn't wrinkled, and clears his throat. Frédéric Dupont grips the podium. The benches are filled, the balconies filling, his buddies urging him on. With a pensive hand, he mops his scalp, mustering his few remaining hairs, and launches into his grand diatribe. First, with a devastated gesture, he evokes the tragedy of Cao Bang and deplores the material and moral abandonment in which our heroic expeditionary corps was left. Scattered laughter breaks out. The secretaries note that quips are coming from all sides. The lights are bright. Dupont feels a vague distress. On the governmental benches, the ministers are fidgeting. In his telling, the army in Indochina is short of everything, and stabbing an accusatory finger toward the secretary of the armed forces, Dupont shouts, anguished and scarlet in the face, that they even had to replace their barbed wire with bamboo spikes. Max Brousset, this is an outrage! Max Brousset's retort is memorable. And like everything having to do with memory, it originates in a slow sedimentation. For him to effectively shout, "This is an outrage," in just the right circumstances, required several generations of notables. From Max Brousset's goiter, the expression takes root in the gorge of his grandfather Jean-Baptiste, a senator and the president of the notaries of the Haute-Saône, a marvelous function. Max, for his part, was a member of the Honorary Committee and the Steering Committee of the Revue des Deux Mondes, which has always been generous. He was also an owner of Radio Méditerranée, then CEO of Satas, a company that made postage meter machines, of a patented model endowed with an exclusive and revolutionary process named after the wild boar. But then we see him as an advisor to the National Electric Company, then to L'Oréal, then to Henkel France, which produced adhesives and detergent. He's a flexible guy, Max. With his pleasant radio face, he adapts, moving from radio waves to postage stamps, from stamps to the distribution of electricity, and from electricity, which brightens life, to cosmetics, which are accessory to it, and from cosmetics, which beautify, to detergents, which corrode. His wife Marie was a Valérie Radeau, the pride of the bourgeoisie. In the 16th century, the Radeau were merchants, handing down a modest coffer and clipboard from...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?